mission of Eliezer, which was to collect the wife for Yitzchak. Fascinating story. Now, Perek Chaf-Dalet in Bereishis, the Avram Zakein, and Avram was old, Baba Yamim, had entered into his old age, days,
and God had blessed Avram with everything. Interesting, just tangentially, how old was Avram at the time? In other words, when he sends, of course one can ask, what is the purpose? Of telling us this, what's the connection with the story?
Right.
Here, in simple terms, I don't think we need a deep idea here. I think it's not a problem. It makes, what's the purpose of, why is the Torah telling us this? What's the relationship between this and what follows?
That's why he couldn't go out and tell the wife.
Good. That's some of the information we have there. In other words, two things. First of all, it means to say that this was the time when this was the, basically his mission in life had been, all of his objectives had been accomplished, and he had one thing left to do. And he could not put it off any longer because he was an old man. And he had to deal. You see one thing. You see one thing, and this is very, very important. And that is that the perfection, what do you see from this? What lesson do you deduce from this? In terms of human perfection, the perfection of the Avos. The Avos represent models of perfection for us. And,
I know, it's okay. Like, was it Socrates before he died? He had to take care of the last debt that, or the last job that he had to do before he died.
Yeah, true. One of these is something which we, I don't know if we focus on enough in contemporary times. One of the main aspects of perfection is how people relate to the fact of their own death. That's an important element. Not just the ability to face death when it comes, that's true, that goes without saying, but to anticipate one's death and to prepare. Not just prepare yourself, that's personal. Yeah. To be concerned about the state of affairs after you're not part of the scene anymore. That's something you don't see too often. Yeah, it's part of all part, but you do not see that. You don't see it in certain leaders. I'm not being critical or whatever. You're going to have to use your own judgment where you want to apply this. But it's an important, one thing you see is that clearly every one of the, I mean it seems that, of course to say it sounds very obvious, but it's one thing to know something in the abstract, it's another thing to accept it and live by it. That all of the great people lived with the awareness that their life was temporal and that they would not be part of this scene forever. Now that sounds like an obvious thing, but emotionally most people don't accept that. Emotionally most people, they'll acknowledge the fact they're going to die, but they don't, right, they don't incorporate that idea into their emotional life. They act and they live, even in the 70s, as though they're going to be around forever. They can't conceive of the idea that that this world will exist without them. And really, even if people can conceive of it, they really don't care too much about it. They don't have the same energy. In other words, most of their energy is
anyway.
Exactly. But the perfected person who does true chesed is just as concerned about, because he's doing chesed for the sake of God, therefore he's concerned about the state of mankind. So what difference does it make whether it's the state of mankind when he's part of it or whether he's not part of it? You see? So therefore, anyone who's discovered a good, something of value, and is not purely out for what he gets out of it, but for the benefit of the world, because that's the will of God, will take steps, insofar as within his power, to see to it that there's continuity after he is after he's gone as well. That's an important principle, by the way, and this is not just for leaders, more so for leaders. To anticipate the situation after they're gone. You see, by the way, of course, that the idea that no great Jewish leader had a notion of being here, you know, forever, of being immortal, or of any kind of a concept that he'd be returning. He acts clearly as though he's gone and he's not going to come back.
There's no hint. Well, I mean, the great leaders of the Torah. Why this is very important. This is very important because today a lot of people act as those, you know, not that is not to deny the resurrection. We do believe in the resurrection, physical resurrection. That's the principle of the Torah. There will be a resurrection, but that's a different idea. You see, when who will be resurrected, and when it will come, and whatever. That's a different concept, but that does not play a role. You cannot allow ideas like that to play a role in determining how you act vis-a-vis the world. In other words, your concern when you contemplate leaving the world is as though you're never going to come back. That's the way you've got to act. That does not mean that we don't believe in the resurrection. That's a separate idea. And I'll explain that at a different time. Today's the subject of today is not the resurrection. We can take it up at a different time. Okay. Now, this, by the way, applies to everybody. So don't just think in terms of leaders and movements, but even in your personal life. I mean, obviously, you're too young, you're not in that phase where you think about these things, but when you get older and you have children and so on and so forth, making arrangements for what will happen after you're gone, that's something that people are very reluctant to do. They don't get involved in it, or they think it's not, well, I mean, within reason. Obviously within reason, but to take measures to set up a situation so that, you know, the things you try to accomplish even within the realm of your family should be smooth even after you're gone. That's a measure of a person's perfection. You see, David Amel, every one of the great people were concerned. They faced death realistically and recognized that it imposes certain responsibilities upon them. You see that David was involved in establishing Shlomo as the king while he was close to death. And you see, Yaakov, before he dies, he gives out the brachos. The brachos were extremely important. All of these things. Here a person completely faces the reality and is totally involved. All of his energies are involved to helping to bring about perfection in a future situation of which he will not be a part. Yaakov will not be part of it, but it makes no, insofar as the obligations of Chesed are concerned, it makes no difference. The situation now is Klal Yisrael. Klal Yisrael is an abstract concept which exists throughout time, and not only the time of which he's a part of it. He's not a part of it anymore. Well, he's a part of it in a different way, obviously, but I mean part of it in the experiential sense. Okay. Well, Raited, in fact, made that point when years ago he explained the Chesed of Avram. That Avram was concerned about future generations. Contrasting it to the chesed of, like today there are people that are Baalei Chesed, they give a tremendous amount of tzedakah. But it's all for the present time of which they're a part. I can use that example, like environmental. You see, the very people that do give a lot of charity, right, do help a lot, but at the same time they don't care if they're destroying the environment. Because while they're around, they're not going to experience the effects. And the future has no reality for them. That's putting it a little bit better. The future has no reality for them. That's another defect. That is to say that your whole concept of reality, you can't separate it from your own ego. Reality to you is only that which is like a childish concept. Because the child has no reality outside of his own ego.
Right.
He can't contemplate a reality apart from his ego. You see, that's exactly why people are really unconcerned when they read about atrocities that are happening in their own day and age, but it's in Bosnia, Serbia, whatever it's saying, as long as it's not in your framework, your ego framework. So it doesn't affect you. And certainly, if it's in a future, the future has no reality unless you're part of that future. You see? So if we're talking about the activities you're doing now are going to bring about a harm 500 years from now, and people are going to suffer from it, certain types of diseases, because of habits that we're engaged in right now, you know, it has no reality. What are you talking about? There's no such thing. You can't relate to such a thing. Okay. That's a very important point. From a practical standpoint, that's what Naomi's saying, that explains why he didn't go on the mission personally, because he was at a different phase of his life. He was old. And he chose someone who... That also shows his greatness. But he didn't have to do everything himself. He recognized his limitation. He was a tremendously powerful individual. He was capable of defeating a coalition of the four kings. They were the strong ones, to save Lot. But yet he realized... His
his limitations, and that Eliezer was better suited for the task. So those are the two reasons. One is that now is the time to do it. You can't put it off. And secondly, it explains why he had to get Eliezer, because if he was not Zuckin, then why wouldn't he do it himself?
Right.
Okay. It's a good question, but that's the kind of question I put aside. I'll tell you why, because it's not a problem.
Right.
It's describing the state of Avram. He was blessed with everything. And what did he choose to use it for? I think that's going to come in later. You see that Eliezer leaves laden with all of the wealth. All of the wealth, it is indicating that God had blessed him with everything. And what was the blessing? The blessing was that he should have all the material benefits, not because he was a materialist, but to use it for the proper purpose. But as I say, there's a lot of things I want to know. Why does the Torah say this? Why is it? But it's not a problem. It's only, I raise it as a problem when there's something in there that shouldn't be there. That's completely out of place. You see? Okay. So, but Pasuk Aleph is in place. It's telling us about the state of Avram and why at this point in his life it's necessary to engage on this mission. Okay? Let's proceed. Now Avram said to his servant, or a slave, whatever you want to call it, the elder of his house, but he was a very unusual kind of a slave. It's very interesting, because this is an agar again. On the way home, somebody asked me a question. I tell you, I want to think about it, and I still want to think about it. That Eliezer is only referred to hardly ever referred to by his name. He's always referred to as Ha'ish or Avdo, Vayomar Eved, the Eved said. But we're talking about someone who's a very distinguished person, Eliezer. And the Torah does refer to him by name, right? But in the story, throughout the story, he's always El Abdo Zakan Beso, that's Eliezer. Hamoshe Abuchalashlo, who had complete control over everything that belonged to Avram. In other words, he was an unusual person. He was a person he wasn't a slave in the ordinary sense, but he was a high level individual and highly perfected individual and highly knowledgeable. Avram trusted him with everything. Okay. Now he says, please place your hand beneath my groin. Now that is for the sake of the Shvuah. Okay. Now, I'm not concerned as to why this was the manner in which they did the Shvuah. That's really, basic idea is because of Bris Milah. It's a reference, because it makes sense. What is a person, when a person is swearing, on the basis of what? What is the value of your Shvuah? The value of your Shvuah is only based upon the value of your philosophy of life. If a person, you follow what I'm saying?
So that's in reference to
that. Yeah, in other words, it's in reference to my whole philosophy of life, which is the philosophy that we all exist because of God, and our whole perfection depends upon, our relationship depends upon fulfilling God's commandments. So therefore, it's in reference to cheftishal mitzvah. That's why a person swears over an object of mitzvah. Because that's my whole philosophy of life. And therefore, not to keep it would involve a loss in terms of my real perfection. Oh, so that's something worth. But the idea that somebody, I swear to you, but if I don't know what the person's whole value system is, what good is your swearing? If you live in a purely instinctual framework, you see people, because you know, most people that live by the instincts, so they'll swear. That's a momentary feeling to swear, and then they'll break it.
Well, they have to swear.
Because another emotion came along. You made the shvua in one frame of mind. That was your emotion of today. And then a week later, you broke it because you were in a different frame of mind. That was your emotion of that day. It was more important to go out and buy a dress, so you couldn't go out and you couldn't do what you said you'd do for me. That's a person that lives by the whim of the moment. So what good is their oath? Absolutely meaningless.
Well, that's why they swear over.
But a person that lives by the chumash, mm-hmm. by mitzvos, by a system of mitzvos, not just by the whim of the moment, and has a concept of perfection in terms of relating to God and subordinating your emotion in the moment to a system of mitzvahs, that's a person that I could trust. Even then, there's no absolute guarantees, but that is something I'll, if I have to trust people, I'll put my trust on. That's why the idea of tachas, that's a very important concept, because that was a reference to their mitzvah that they had. Yeah, that they had, that's clearly what mitzvah more than that shows the subordination of man in terms of the physical. He's undergoing tremendous physical pain for the sake of the higher good. The mitzvah of Mila demonstrates that to the utmost. The capacity to do something which is emotionally and physically repugnant to a person. That shows that you don't live, you don't base the good in terms of how you're emotional. Most people live their lives, their whole concept of the good is that which is pleasing to them. And here, the mitzvah of meal, we say that the Torah wants you to be happy, but the real happiness does not come by following that those emotions, and sometimes you have to do something which is completely emotionally repugnant to you. So you can't live by your feelings. Your sense of what is good and what's bad has absolutely no relationship to the ultimate reality. Now, of all the mitzvahs, that I would say perhaps milah represents that the most. And you see, especially a parent, does that the obligation to have your child circumcised. That's very, very painful to a parent. And that's, I'm not saying that's the whole idea of milah. There's more to it, but that certainly carries with it that notion. Okay? Now we're getting into the what is the shvuah? He wants to take an oath, and I will, you know, cause you to take an oath. Yeah. I want you to swear. Yeah. It's better sometimes to go over the facts again.
Okay.
By the way, that's what people don't understand. Kriya Satara on Shabbos. Very few people relate to it properly. Remind me to explain to you the two brachos. Why the Birkas Satara. Because the whole philosophy just in those two brachas. The first bracha, Shabbat Mikolam, Vinas Lanos Torah Sao, Bracha Hashem Nos Nina Torah. And the bracha afterward is Ashenas Lanos Torah Emes, Vachai Olam Nata Bezachainu, Bracha Hashem Nos Nina Torah. What's the difference between the two brachas? Why is there a change in the form? They're both, the ending is the same in both. It's Shevach for the giving of the Torah. So which is it? Why? Which one is, why two, and why this one first and that one second? Okay. Remind me to explain. You say that the whole institution of Kriya, it's really Limud HaTorah. Moshe was Masakin, and then Ezra expanded on it. When the Jews went in the wilderness for
three days
without water in hand, it's a reference to Torah.
Mm-hmm.
So the real essence of the idea is Talmud Torah, is learning of Torah. You see? But we don't, we're Mekayim it at the most minimal level, which is to actually hear. But hearing is the beginning of Talmud Torah. You gotta listen carefully to the words. And people feel it's just, well, I heard this 100 times, what's the point? It's just, they don't realize, no, it's learning. And every time you listen to the word, every nuance, you get a new, you don't realize how many ideas you pick up just by, I noticed certain things in Kriya Satara. Like, a couple of years ago I noticed something you may have, there's so much in the Torah you can't notice it the first time, the second time. And even the millionth time, there's nuances. Like it says that when Lot separated from Avram, it says that he lifted up his eyes and he saw the entire plain, right? It's describing why he chose Sodom, because it was so beautiful and lush, you know, filled with all kinds of goodness. It says, Lefnei Shachas Hashem, before God destroyed, you know, the cities of Sodom, Kegan Hashem, Kerem, etc. So a question occurs to me, well, of course he saw it. Why does it have to point out to you that he saw it before God destroyed? Nobody would write the story that way. Of course he saw it before it was destroyed. He saw it in its beauty, so obviously we know it. And then you read 2 pages later, that Lot was destroyed. It should have said he saw the entire plain of the Yarden, how beautiful it was, and he chose, and then he went there, and then the angels came, and then it was destroyed, you know. What do you mean he saw it before it was destroyed? That's, no one would write the story that way. It doesn't make sense. You follow? It's that's a problem. That's a problem. Then I worked out a shiur on the basis of that. But during Kriya Satara, it occurred to me. Like, it doesn't. You should listen for those nuances, things that don't fit. There's no follow. There's no one would describe would write a book that way. Doesn't make sense. Now, what's the shvuah? To swear by God, the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of the earth, that you shall not take a woman for my son from the daughters of the Canaanim that I dwell amongst. That's part one. But only to my land and my birthplace shall you go, and you will take a woman, a wife, for my son Yitzchak. So apparently it seems that there's two parts to the oath. One is that you're not to take a girl from Canaan.
Where was Canaan?
Where he was living. Canaan is what we, the entire land of Israel is referred to as Canaan. The land of the seven nations, but Canaan was the most distinguished, so it's known by the Canaanim. Canaan.
So Artsy is Canaan?
No. Artsy is back to where he comes from. Haran, or Aram Narayim, right?
So they don't give a name, the whole, that's what I noticed. They never give a name, the place where
Yeah. I don't know if it means Dafka Charan or Aram Narayim. It doesn't. I'm not really that concerned at this point. There's a more specific thing, though. There's a more specific issue. Was he instructed to go to choose from that land, or only from the family? That's not clear. That's a machlokas among the Rishonim. If you take a look later on, you see, you have to read this story in context with what happens later on, because later on he does. We know what happens. Eliezer. Well, that's strange. That's my next. That's phase two. His strange methodology of choosing right. wife. That whole thing by the Be'er and whatever. That whole thing, right. which some say is like, look, it appears on the surface to be like nichush, like divination. The Ram, the Chazal say. Right. Yes, Prabhu. That's phase two. I'm working on that right now. When he finds a wife and he is negotiating with Lavan, seems like Lavan or Besuel or whatever, with the family, for them to agree, to consent, to give Rivka, he provides, he tells over the whole story. It's like a lot of right. a lot of superfluous stuff. He tells, yeah, but if you check what he says then, it's a little, it's not, sometimes it's different, but yeah, sometimes there's omissions, but sometimes it's clarification. Take a look, Tal Lamed Zayin and Lamed Ches. He's telling over the family because he wouldn't eat until he took care of his business. And he says, my master caused me to swear, saying, do not take a wife for my son from the daughters of Canaan, Asher Anochi, that I'm living in their land. Okay. Pretty the same. He said Bekirvo, he said Biarch. So, well, I don't know if there's anything of him. Imlo, I'll base Avi, Teleth, go to the house of my father. And my family. That's not what Avram said, what we just read. Here it said to go back to the birthplace, the land, which could indicate even if it wasn't from his family. Here it indicates that it's from the family. Now, that's a machlokas among the mafarshim, whether the instruction was to pick somebody from the family, badafka, or from the land, which would be more, you know, which would be broad. If that's the case, then we have to understand why Eliezer mentioned family. Right? Okay. I mean, you could say that it makes more sense to say that there was family, but you could say that that the indication was not limited just to family. But he said that when he said it to them to win them over to the idea that it's possible that he made it seem like it was just the doctor of the family. Whatever. At this point in time, it's not of importance to us. For our purposes today, it's not that important. Okay. Then the Evet said, perhaps she will, and he asked the question, perhaps the woman will not want to come after me to this land. Shall I return your land to the land that you left? Okay.
Wait.
That's the Evet. Now, bear in mind, one of my questions, is this just a factual question, or is there an idea behind it?
Right.
Like a Havamina, so to speak. Is there like a Machlokas? Like we said of a Machlokas. I mean, the Torah doesn't have to record all the details. Right? When he asks the question, I'm sure the conversations, you know, are much greater than what the Torah records. The Torah just records the essence. It doesn't record, it's not a history book. So, what was Eliezer's concept? You see, because Avram vehemently disagrees with him, so it's not just a factual issue. Now, listen carefully. Vayom Elav, Avram, and Avram said, Hisham Elacha. Take heed, guard yourself, lest you return my son there. Now it becomes extremely strange. You have to tell me what's strange. And he says, God, the Lord of Lord, the God of heaven, who took me out from the house of my father, and from the land of my birth, and who spoke to me, and who swore to me, saying, to your children will I give this land. He will send his angel before you, and you will take a wife for my son from there. Okay, this is new information, inside information. And if the woman doesn't want to go after you, then you shall be free from this oath. But my son, you shall not bring back there. Okay, now Rashi says something very fascinating over here. Take a look at Rashi on Vinikisa, Mishvasizos says. Ramban argues with him, but Rashi says, "V'kachlo isha v'bnos aner eshkol amri." Rashi is basing himself on a medrash. You'll be free from this oath, and then you'll be free, and you'll be, in other words, completely free from the oath. And then you'll be permitted to take a wife from one Eresh Kel Mamre. They were his comrades, so to speak. Hein Bali Bris Avram. He had a agreement with them. And they were from Canaan. So this is, according to Rashi, I'm going to learn it according to Rashi. It adds another question. Because, now you have a real Mamanavshach question. At first it seems like it's the most horrible thing in the world to take a wife from Canaan. Right? That's part of the shul. But if you go, so therefore you got to get out of here and you got to go there. But if it turns out that you can't get a wife, so he said, okay, so let's say I find a girl over there, but she won't come. So his thought was, it's logical to bring him, no, can't do it. So what do? Then according to Rashi, then you can take a girl from Oner Eshkol Mamre, which is Canaan. So if that's the case, why do you have to go through this whole rigmarole? I would imagine that for some unknown reason, there's no, he's ruled out the girls of Canaan for some unknown reason. They can't. But it turns out that they really can marry them. If you really can marry them, so why do you have to go through this? It's only after you've gone through this. But there's a bigger problem. There's a bigger problem over here. On Lamed Zayin and Lamed Ches. In the answer of Avram, there's a tremendous problem. I mean, you have to be able to distinguish between problems and knockout punches.
Well, because he doesn't say.
God's angel, of course, over here means forces of nature, providence.
Right, to set to choose a wife.
Yeah.
So then why
just... No. You'll be successful because God will send, in other words, God will direct His providence to cause you to succeed in your mission. But you have to go, obviously. Right? That's one question. I mean, what it would appear, what's Avram's answer?
If it's going to work, then why isn't it going
to work? If Avram, Avram seems to be telling him that he knows the
Ashkacha. It's
going to
work like this.
No. Excuse me. Slow down. Let's state the question, and then you'll have every opportunity to argue with me. Okay. But let's. The plain meaning of Pasuk Zayin is that he's answering him that there's no problem. His question was, "What should I do if this situation arises?" And he seems to be saying that he has inside information. Now we didn't know this at the beginning. Because Avram didn't reveal it at the beginning. But it would seem from the plain meaning is, I'm telling you, I know that God who spoke to me and who promised me is going to send his angel, so to speak, that is the Ashkacha, and you'll take a wife from there. Meaning you'll take a wife from there, you'll be successful. Doesn't mean that you'll take a wife from there, but you won't want to come back. Because what good is that?
Why not?
Because that's not what he means. Plain meaning is Lakachta, you'll... If that's the plan, if the plan was to find a wife... Hey, if the plan was to find a wife from there and bring her back here, because Yitzchak can't go there,
right.
And now I'm telling you, I know that this mission has to succeed because God's going to direct it. So it wouldn't make sense that you'd find a woman that didn't want to come back. That's what he's telling him. Don't worry, because what good is it to say that you'll find a woman but you won't want to come back? So then God's not helping you. I mean, that's not what I need, right? I mean, it's like saying. You're sending someone to go to Australia to find the shidduch, but you can't leave America. You have to stay to learn. You can't go, okay? And so what? I have to go to why Australia? I know you're going to succeed, but what if I find the right girl and she doesn't want to come back here? So I'm saying, look, I know you're going to succeed in the mission because I know the Ashkach will work. So I'm telling you that you will find a girl who will want to come back. I mean, that's pretty clear.
Why is it necessarily who will want to come back?
Because that's the whole idea. What good is it if she doesn't want to come back? So why, Mamanashach? So if Avram can't, if he can't give that guarantee, if his knowledge of the future does not include that, so what does it help Eliezer? Eliezer was not questioning that I'll find such a girl. Eliezer was confident that he could, but what if I find the girl and she doesn't want to come back? So Avram's whole retort is to dispel that problem. And then the answer is, I'm telling you, I know God spoke to me and said you'll find it, you'll take it from there. I mean, he's not, we're concerned that he won't find the wife at all. Eliezer didn't ask, if you tell me, that's another question. Hold on a second. Notice, you could ask, how come Eliezer didn't ask, what if I don't find the girl altogether? That's not what he asks. Okay? So that's not the issue. I mean, if what Avram would have said, again, Avram would have given the same answer probably. If this is true, that he knows that God's Ashkacha, that the mission is under the Ashkacha, So then he would have given the same answer. But Elias's question was different. Alright? You can ask, why didn't he ask a more primary question? But his question was, let's say I find the girl and she doesn't want to come back. So why reassure him that you're going to find a girl who may not want to come back? That's his question. The whole reassurance is that the mission will succeed. So then how could it be, if that's the case, then Pasuk Ches doesn't make any sense. Because Pasuk Zayin is telling him that the Ashkach is that it's going to work out. And she'll want to come back. And Pasuk Ches, but how can there be a but? If God's going to send his angel, then it's got to work. So what's the but? That's the contradiction. That's the problem. If Avraham wants to just tell him what the answer is, see, the whole answer would be fine if Pasuk Zion wasn't in there. Pasuk Zion is entirely superfluous altogether. What do you need that? What does it have to do with? He didn't ask for a history lesson either, Eliezer. He just wants a point of information. So Pasuk Zion, one can say, is entirely superfluous. Why does Avraham even have to tell him this? He should have simply told him that if that's the case, because that's what he's going to wind up telling him anyways. In the end, the answer is where? In two places. Yisham alacha pentash vesmin yishama. Right? And v'yim lo soveh, if the woman that you find doesn't want to come back, then you're free of this oath. I mean, so that's the answer. So what does he need, Zion? I mean, aside from my problem, you don't even need Zion because it doesn't add anything. It seems to be totally superfluous. For whatever reason, given that he does, once he does bring it on the table, it creates a problem. Because it seems to be saying that I know you're going to succeed and there's no way you can fail. So if that's the case, it obviates Pasuk Ches. Pasuk Ches doesn't make sense. How could it be? There can't be a contingency of Im Lo Soveh when I know that God's going to send his angel and he's going to be successful. So I think he didn't have to give him the information in the first place. But being that he did give him the information, it obviates, then what are you talking about? I mean, assume Eliezer believes in God and all that. So now it becomes extremely complicated. The question is, like you said, first of all, why couldn't Yitzchak search for life? How old was Yitzchak at the time this takes place? He was 37. And Avram was 137.
My goodness.
So Avram, when this occurs, he has 38 years left to live. I mean, he lived till 175. Okay, these are the basic questions, obvious questions. Why not? Why couldn't he choose a wife from Benos Kanani? According to Rashi, it seems that he could, but only after he went through this procedure.
And why couldn't he move?
B'dieved, right.
Why couldn't he move back to his land?
Yeah, of course, and why couldn't Yitzchak leave the land? Well, you see, those two questions are interconnected.
Right.
They're, in other words, like this. I don't think we should imagine that Yitzchak was deemed to be incapable or had nothing to say. It wasn't a setup. No, you see later on that when they come, it seems like providential, when they come back. Well, providence does play a very important role in the story. We just have to figure out how. On the way back, they just he happened to be Losuch. He was going for a walk. Losuch says he was a spal, whatever. I mean, but he was going for a walk in the fields, and they happened to be in the same path, quite by chance, would seem. And she saw him from afar. That's very interesting, that story, that whole meeting. And then she jumps off the camel and says, "Who is that man?" And that's my master, and whatever. And she was there. And what? She puts her veil on. What's the significance of all that? See, that's how everything bothers me, is because why is the Torah telling me these details? So what? The Torah doesn't record anything which is just historical. I mean, just who cares? And this doesn't seem to be that important. At all events, you see from there that the decision was made by Yitzchak.
Why? From there?
Yeah, because it says that the Eved told Yitzchak everything that happened. It doesn't say that he reported back to Avram. At no point does it say that he reported back to Avram. At no point does it say that Avram made the decision. The decision was made by Yitzchak. The selection was made by Eliezer at the behest of Avram, but Yitzchak had to give his okay. You don't imagine that Yitzchak would get married not knowing anything about the woman just because Eliezer decided
it was.
The answer to the question as to Yitzchak apparently seems to revolve around the idea that Yitzchak couldn't leave the land. That's one of the main themes in the story, is that Yitzchak could not leave the land. We'll try and find out why that's so in a minute. There's a chazal on that. But that would explain why
Eliezer.
Eliezer, yeah. In other words, The marriage of Yitzchak was extremely important, obviously, and it necessitated, well, there were two things over there. First of all, he could not choose. For certain reasons, you couldn't choose from Benos Canaan. And therefore, it demanded that you go to, back to his mishpacha. Let's learn to his mishpacha. Now, Yitzchak couldn't do that because he couldn't leave the land. So that would remove the question. It's not, well, we can no longer ask, why couldn't Yitzchak choose a wife? The other thing is, though, according to this Rashi that says, V'kach l'ishiv v'bnos ader eshkol mamri, would indicate, according to Rashi anyways, that even if the plan, if the mission failed, and now he goes to plan two, he v'kachlo and take for him.
Still, see? Has
yeah. What does indicate, according to Rashi, that the that it's not so simple. That even if the girl were from this land, and there was no problem of going to Chutz La'aretz, you would have to pick for Yitzchak. Okay, okay. But we'll keep that in the background for the time being. At least as far as the mission is concerned, we understand that Yitzchak couldn't go on the mission. Any other questions? Okay, so with two things. We want to know why it couldn't be from Canaan, and what was the superiority of going back to his homeland? Because he had to, you can't say there were great tzaddikim over there, because that was a play. Yeah, he had to leave because they were going to kill him. Or whatever, I mean... he couldn't fulfill his mission as long as he stayed there. So it doesn't seem like neither people were righteous people. So why is it better this way? Okay. Any other questions? Now, of course, then we have the question I mentioned about the debate between Eliezer. In other words, I'm saying Eliezer didn't just ask. Eliezer's havamina was that he should return. If I found the right woman and she wouldn't come back, he only asked Avram because he thought there was a havamina that he should take him back. It was a clarification. So we'll set it up like a machlokas. The next question, as we've said, is the strange answer of Avram. That Avram, the answer should simply been that don't bring him back. But he gives him this whole, what seems to be a reading of the Hashkacha, what God is going to do, which indicates that the plan is going to succeed, and then tells him, but if it doesn't, which seems to be contradictory. Okay? Any other questions? Am I leaving out anything? Yeah, one other question that permeates. Some things are so obvious that you don't ask them. I think you girls were talking about this before, though, Sarah.
Yeah, why was it so important that he make a shul?
Yeah, why is it necessary that he take a shul? Here I think we can ask the, again, Manashach question. I mean, did he trust Eliezer or not?
Right.
It would seem that he did. Now, Eliezer was a very high-level person. You know, the Chazal say that he wanted his daughter to marry Yitzchak. And you say what a tzaddik he was, that even though he wanted his daughter, but still he did everything possible to fulfill the mission according to Avram. Avram rejected it. And now there's another thing. You see, in the case, to show you why it's a good question, whenever you cause somebody to take a shvua, it's always because there's a certain kind of a resistance. You want to strengthen the matter. Like in the case, like the Ramban asked, why did Yaakov make Yosef take the shul? Didn't he trust him? And he takes pains to show him that he says the shul wasn't because of that. The shul was for the sake of Paro. That there'd be resistance. That Paro might not want to let you, because they revered Yaakov. They may want to have Yaakov buried in Egypt. It would be a tremendous distinction for them. And therefore, when Yosef would go to Paro, see, again, he anticipates the future. So it would be much... He'd have a greater leverage with him if he said, I made a shvua, as opposed to just arguing on the... just making a plea, but so Paro could reject it. But he says, I made a shvua, an oath, you because of me to violate an oath I made to my father, that would give him leverage. You see? But generally speaking, why would you cause somebody else to take an oath, in general? Someone that you trust. Let's analyze that. Let's say you're asking someone to do something for you. And this thing is extremely important, and you get them to take an oath, or to promise me. We recognize there's a difference between when a person says, I'll do it, gives you their word, I'll do it. And when they say, well, promise me, or when they say, I promise. But promise isn't really necessarily a halachic thing. Do you swear, you know, a shvua? Now, if a person thinks a shvua, that, well, why? Well, let's ask ourselves the question, what is the difference? Either the person is a trustworthy person, the person of MS, of truth, and if they gave you their word, you rely on that, or they're not a person of MS, in which case the shvua really wouldn't be that good, right? Yeah, we do recognize that there's a certain benefit. You feel more confident when you ask somebody to do something for you when they're in Israel or whatever, and you know that they took a shvu that they would do it. You certainly, and they're of course halachic, you feel more confident than if they just gave you their word. Nomi hit it right on the head. I think Nomi hit it right on the head. And that is that there is a difference. Because if you say you're going to do something, so you have to be honest. But to what extent, how far do you have to go? Now, that always means, given the situation, you made a certain effort, you know, you were true to your word. But once it becomes a shvua, now it's part of your whole relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, it's a completely, in a different framework. It's in a totally different framework. So therefore, your obligation would be much, much greater, to the extent that you'd only be pater if it was an impossibility or something. And even then, you'd want to be matir than that. You know, you're putting it in a different framework. Okay. So that's why when a person takes a shvua, it's a much greater guarantee. Now, if that's the case, why over here it doesn't seem like it's necessary, because it's hard for us to understand why would Eliezer care one way or the other? I mean, he trusts what's in it for him? What difference, you know what I mean? In the case of Yosef, Yaakov and Yosef, we understand that the problem was that Yosef might encounter resistance. He might encounter resistance. It would be difficult for him to do it. So, whether you say it's because he needed it for Paro, practical, or whether you say, that the difficulties would be so great for Yosef that if he just gave his word without a shvua, that he might feel free. I did everything I had. You don't have to learn like Rambam. You could say that Yaakov wanted to make him bound by an oath so that he would go above and beyond, because there would be resistances. Either way. But where are the resistances over here? What does Eliezer care?
Well, what you said before.
That Eliezer wants to schlep him back?
No.
That's what I'm saying. He's shamalachah.
He wants it from his own daughter.
So that if anything, he wouldn't bring him back. Then if anything, it's just the opposite. In other words, you're saying that Eliezer has a motive, but that motive would be in line with Avram's desire. In other words, not to bring Yitzchak to... Don't you see what you're saying? To make him swear not to bring him back to where I came from, right, would imply that he may have some desire, that Eliezer would have some desire to do so.
Right.
Okay? But if you say that Eliezer secretly wished him to marry his own daughter, right? Then if anything, he wants the mission to fail. He doesn't want, according to that emotion, would not want Yitzchak to marry the girl over there. Therefore, he wouldn't even ask the question. If the girl didn't want to come back, he'd be thrilled to come home and give Yitzchak his own daughter. You see? So if anything, the emotions would be not to bring Yitzchak back. So, but look, Yaakov says, he warns him, he shamalacha. And Toshav Espinishama, you guard yourself. He really goes out of his way to strengthen the case, the warning. And that was the whole lesson of the Shvua. My question is, though, what's he worried about? Why would Eliezer care? What does he care? He's just asking for information, what to do. But if you tell me that the answer is no, so fine, it's okay with me. I don't have any. There's no resistance he has to overcome in order not to bring him there. Okay, those are the questions. The show is the ascending. That's why you read the story first. You get an idea of what the theme is, what the main theme is, what the main issues, and then you question. Then you break it down into components. What the main issues. Also, you have to learn how to separate the main questions from the side questions. Okay. Well, you could ask more questions, but They may not be that important at the moment. You'll come back to them later. It's very important because you got to focus on the main questions. They're the gateway into the ideas. Once you open up the story, then other things will come into focus. The next step that we have to take in the search for knowledge of Chumash. Okay? Read the story carefully. Isolate the story, by the way. Isolation is very important. Well, sometimes you're just reading through the whole, you're reading so much, you can't focus on any one thing. First thing is to focus, to isolate this segment. Here's a story by itself. Usually when it's small, I could deal with it. So I decided this itself, the charging of Eliezer. That's all. I'm not doing the whole story. I'm just doing the charging of Eliezer with the mission. That itself is a unit. Okay? Which should be studied. And once you have that, you have a small unit, you can focus. You can focus. That's very important. Otherwise, you keep going on and on. I mean, you can't focus on anything. So first you have to delineate the issue, the story, whatever it is. Okay. Then you go through it, and then you get, you read the psukim carefully, and you get a sense of the questions. Okay? Because this is like Zion is a gem. You've discovered a gem in Zion and Cheres, that contradiction. That's something, because it reads okay. When you read it, it sounds from, it sounds nice. The problem is, we're too from. Everybody's from, and we're okay, and then the angel will come. But if she doesn't come, not realizing that you're not making sense. It sounds good, it sounds from, But we don't care anyways, because it all works out happily in the end anyways, everything. Well, you know the end anyways. It all works out happily. He does find the girl. Right? Just everything works out perfectly. Got to be careful, because if you read the story, it can reinforce, like a lot of these fairy tale ideas. If he reads like a fairy tale, then he goes to the water and he makes up this thing, and that's as soon as the next phase is what? When you have a lot of questions, you have to make a decision as to which one to answer first, the order of answers. Which one am I going to focus on? Well, yeah, sometimes. I have two rules that I use. Sometimes I could sense that this is the most primary, most basic, and everything sort of revolves around that. That's one way. And that's sometimes intuitional. Right. Sometimes, when I'm not even clear which is the main, then I go for the easiest one. Just get answers on the table. Then I'll just go for the easier one. And one will lead. In other words, I want to get a little momentum going, so I'll choose the ones which I feel are the easiest to answer. That may not be the best method in terms of the theme of the story. Just because it's easier doesn't mean it's going to... But if I'm not sure which one to deal with immediately, I just want to get momentum going. I want to get more information on the table. Now here, which is the one we should focus on first? We should focus on first... What? Yeah. Why Yitzhak couldn't leave. That's primary. Everything revolves around that. If Yitzhak could leave, then... The whole issue would be different. Right, that's very primary. That'll lead us into a lot of things. Now on that, there's a very important Rashi, which is in the next Parsha, in Toldos. Alright? Do the Rashi. When there was a famine, that's in Toldos. That's in Toldos, Perakavav, Pasuk Beis, and God, when there was a famine, he wanted to go to Mitzrayim. And God appeared to him and said, do not go down to Mitzrayim, dwell in the land that I will tell you. In other words, stay in the land. Take a look at Rashi. And Rashi on Altered Mitzrayim. Rashi says, Shayadaito, the redness of Mitzrayim. His intention was to go to Egypt, Kavoshe Yarad Aviv, Yimei Harav, as his father had gone down in the time of the famine. Amalo, he said to him, Altered Mitzrayim, don't go down to Egypt. Sha'ata Ola Tamima. Because you are a perfect Ola. Ola means a carbon which is completely consumed on the Mizbeach. V'ein chutzla aretz kedailoch. And chutzla aretz does not behoove you, is not fitting for you. Okay? Here, you must have heard this chazal before. What does it mean? Alright? This is a clear-cut example of a case where you cannot take the words literally, and you have to translate it into ideas that make sense. This is the reason why you couldn't, this tells you a great deal about Yitzhak, but specifically
why he couldn't leave the land. What's one thing I have to do? What is an Ela Tamima? And when you apply the concept to a human being, and what is the what does that have to do with not leaving the land?
The whole story revolves around the Chazal about the character of Yitzchak.
Of course, we see later on Abraham's idea that Yitzchak was not to leave the land is confirmed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu when the famine occurs in Parshas Toldos, and God appears to him in Nevuah and tells him not to leave the land, Shchon Ba'aretz. And Rashi Dukva, why did God have to tell him that? Obviously his intention was to go, because of the famine, to go to Mitzrayim as his father had done, and God therefore
precluded that. And Rashi adds, on the basis of Chazal, an explanation for that, which is very cryptic, very difficult to understand. She'ata Ola Tamima, because you are a unblemished Ola. Now an Ola is a sacrifice which is totally consumed on the altar. Other Karbanos are not totally consumed. Parts of them are to be eaten by the Kohen, and parts are consumed. But the Ola means it's completely consumed. The Ein Chutzlars Kedailach, and Chutzlars is not fitting for you. Okay, so that's what we have to try and define. This is a classical case of one of the Chazals that I'm not sure I would teach children even. Rashi was selected as the commentary par excellence for teaching children, but I don't know, I have a big problem with that. Because sometimes the Rashi gives the plain shot, but sometimes the Rashi quotes Medrashim, which I on the surface are even outlandish. And they were not intended to be taken literally, but unfortunately very often the teacher takes them literally, and that becomes the pshat, and that's what's embedded in the child's mind. So that's a danger. I understand this. I understand the way Rachid explained this. And it's very important, because we do have the concept of the three avos, and that's a necessary component of Klal Yisrael. You couldn't have Klal Yisrael without the three avos. And that's part of Moshe Rabbeinu's argument when he was arguing for the God wanted to destroy the Jews by the Chet HaEgel. And that was according to Rashi, to remember the promise you made to the father. So what he was saying was that, because God's idea was to destroy the Klal Yisrael, and I'll make a new nation out of you. So then there'd only be one founder, only one Av, would be Moshe. And Moshe was alluding to the fact that, this is what Rashi says over there, that if a chair with three legs can't stand before you in your time of wrath, then how will a chair which is on one leg? Very, very profound. Familiar with that Rashi? Very profound,
yeah,
Rashi.
Yeah, you said that.
The three of us thus are a component. In other words, he's saying a nation which is the nation is not just the people who were taken out and given the Torah, but the nation is those people who are the descendants of the three of us. The of us are part of the nation. It's a concept. Klal Yisrael.
So what's the difference if it's one or three?
Ah. Okay. Now there is a difference. But true. Three is not, in other words, our idea of the Avos is part of our character as a nation. You see? In other words, that's part of the idea of Klal Yisrael is not just, it is, of course, the people that received the Torah and so on and so forth, but it is also our identification, our identity as Jews is that we are the B'nai Avram Yosef and Yaakov. That's also extremely important to us. The whole idea of the Maras HaMach Pela and so forth. These are very important ideas. And then you've got to be very careful over here. That's why Chevron has importance. The Maras HaMach Pela is located. It has importance. But what I'm hesitating is not the importance that people attribute to it, and the manner which is being abused, in my opinion, is not the real idea. However, the idea is that, you know, that Yoshua, when he was sent on the mission of the spies, and he went, Chazal say he went and he spread out his body over the Kever Avos to be Mispalo. He was Mispalo, but he shouldn't be Nichshal in the plan of the conspiracy of the spies. So the idea that we're not, Klal Yisrael is not just the people, but it is, that's part of our definition, we are the children of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, is a very important idea. That's what Moshe was saying. That each Av has represents a certain ideal, or a prototype if you want, a certain ideal. and we, that's part of the nation, we seek to, we need it, because we learn Torah not just from the abstract study, which is very, very important, but also extremely important is, and you see that by Moshe at the snare, when he asks for the name, how he shall refer to God when he comes back to Bnei Israel. So there's Ek Yashek, yeah? That's one name, one answer. That's the abstract philosophical concept that we're supposed to have with regard to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And then there's Elokei, tell Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, the God of Avram. You see? Yes. In other words, we derive our ideas from abstract study, but also it's vital to see how these ideas have been implemented in the lives of people that we look up to. That's the teaching. It's very important. That's the mitzvah. What is the mitzvah we're talking about? There's a mitzvah that involves Lehidavik, Uvo Sidbach, really, literally, to cling to God. The Chazal say, how can you cling to God? God's a consuming for them, impossible. So it means to cling to Talmid Chacham. Uvo Sidbach, to cling to him. That's a mitzvah, to cling to God. And the you can't, but by definition, it's an impossibility. And it's to cling to Talmid Chacham, which means that, how do you do, what do you mean cling? It means to be in their company. Chazal say, to marry your daughter to a Talmid Chacham, so he'll be a part of your mishpacha, to do business with Talmid Chacham. In other words, all different activities which cause you to be in community with Talmid Chacham, because they represent certain aspects of perfection that have an effect upon us. That's the way the human psyche is. You see what I'm saying? In other words, that's the whole idea of Kiddush Hashem as opposed to Chilul Hashem. It's people, because let's say a person acts in a way which is disgraceful to Torah. So you say, well, you just disgraced Torah. So I say, no, I mean, Torah is true and everything. I'm just, it's just me. Why I disgrace Torah? I just disgraced myself. But the ideas of Torah are true. Yeah, theoretically you're correct, but the way people function, they associate the reality, it's real. It's real because this person is basing his life and making his decisions upon it. But if they see that he's not, when it comes down to it, he's just as emotional. You see, he's just attached to the material as anybody else. So in their mind, it means the idea is not true. So they need that extra boost. You follow what I'm saying? People are not, except for Yechidim, I mean, obviously there are people that don't need, that are beyond that. But the mankind in general, that's why we have a big problem today. There's very few role models that people can look up to. In the world at large, I mean, unfortunately, even in the Jewish world, I think. It's a tough time. It's basically what Chazal referred to as a Dor Yasmi, an orphan generation. We have leaders. I'm not negating leaders, but in terms of the real Gedolim of the past, it seems to me that we're lacking.
What now?
Each one had a distinctive personality. I don't know if that's a good choice. I don't think that's the word I'm looking for. Identity. They were all perfected individuals, but when we say Elokei Avram, Elokei Yitzchak, Elokei Yaakov, it means that there were different expressions. Yeah, different expressions of the ultimate perfection. That's what Yahad is about, to enable Adam to reach his ultimate perfection. And these people represented that, because each one had that high level of relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and based their lives. Their whole lives were based upon that principle. But it manifests itself in different ways. They weren't identical. Their roles, each one had a role, each one had a mission. See, and each one expressed a different element. Now, that's what it says, Titein emes li Yaakov, chesed li Avraham. Ascribe emes, Yaakov somehow represents emes. And Chazal referred to him as being the Bechir Shebalos, like the most perfect of the Elos, for some reason. Yeah. Having to do with emes. Yaakov.
Yeah.
And Avraham ascribed chesed. Of course, you read all about Avraham, what they focus in on. It doesn't even focus about his tremendous chachma. It's interesting. Yes? But we focus in on his chesed. All the stories about Avraham, really, with the three malachim that came to him and how he ran to take care of them and feed them, was chesed. Okay. Yitzchak doesn't really say anything openly. Now, does that mean that Yaakov didn't partake of chesed? And does that mean that Avram didn't partake of emes? What's that?
Of course not.
Of course not.
Because they were perfected in this part of perfection.
Yes.
But why more in one? Why is one trait more dominant in one person than the other?
I don't mean that it's more dominant.
Okay,
let me try and explain. By the way, I'm just going to try a rough explanation here. I'm not going to define that precisely. But just give you some idea of what it means, what I think it means. Of course, Abraham was partook of MS. That's what, if you read the Rambam about Avram, his whole essence was MS. That's what saved him. He was, it would seem to me, if anyone, he's MS. Okay. But I would say it means like this, that each one of the Elos had two different frameworks. One is their personal life. But you see, in Yahadus, perfection involves two things. This is a very important practical thing to know. All the Gedolim always lived on two different levels. They lived on the level of their personal life. Perfection involves two things. One, to perfect yourself, to save yourself. Which means just you yourself. You have a soul, a divine image, and the objective is to be selfish. By the way, Yahadus is totally selfish. Believes in complete self. A person must be selfish. Gomel nafsho ish tzaddik. The tzaddik is the one who's the most selfish person. If the idea is understood correctly, selfish means doing. Man by definition is a selfish being, but some people, the Russia is the most selfless person. People call him selfish, but he's really, I define selfishness differently. To be selfish means to do that which is best for the self. Okay. To be selfless is to be doing that which is harmful to this, which destroys the self.
But the Russian thinks he's being selfish.
Yeah, he thinks he's being selfish, that's why he's a fool. The Russian is really the fool. Because in his imagination, he's not really selfish. The real selfish person is the tzaddik, because he's getting the best of this existence and he's getting eternal existence. That's the best deal in the world. You follow? He has a better life in this world, according to Yah. This is the best life in this world. It's not a trade-off, by the way, like other religions. Trading off this world from the next. No. Now, your primary goal is to deal with yourself. That is, not to allow your own self, which is basically what's the essence of you, which is the Tel Melakim, to be destroyed. That's your first obligation.
It is.
Your first obligation, to save your own self. By living, because you can't just, you have to save yourself, because if you just follow the course of nature, you're going to be drawn towards the corruption. Since, you follow, the way man is constructed, Yesalev Ha'adam Ramin Urav. That's a very important pasuk. The inclination of a person's heart is ra. So if you just go with the flow, more or less, you're not going to achieve perfection. Perfection cannot be achieved by nature. It's another important disorder. A lot of times, you'll hear this at a funeral sometimes, or whatever. People praise, what they think is praise, is not really praise, because they'll say, this person was such a tzaddik, he was so good, he was just by nature, he couldn't hurt a fly. By nature, he was always kind. And I wonder if it's also, if that is the case, that was his natural emotions, so then he's not a tzaddik. Because it was just an emotion. He was just living according to his emotions. You're telling me that if his emotions were different, then he might have acted differently. That's not the ultimate praise. It's only if you mean that after working on himself, he reached such a level where that it became part of his nature. See, doing good, doing chesed, can become part of your nature. If you study, you know, you live in accordance with Chokhmah, and you redirect your energies to the good, then it will become second nature. That's the end result, you see? But that's not what they mean. They mean by nature he was kind, couldn't hurt a fly. Well, if you tell me that it was just by nature, so that's not a perfection, that's just emotions. And the other person who has aggressive emotions by nature is also living in line with his nature. That's not what you... We don't look up to that. That's not a virtue. The Rambam says that virtue cannot be established by nature. Because, you see, God gave man Bechira. It's got to be a result of Bechira. Bechira means there's a conflict. Let's face it. Can't deny it. There's a conflict. There is a conflict. That's the whole human dilemma, so to speak, a human condition, is that man is a creature of conflict. And if you just... And in order to get yourself out of the conflict, you must have correct truth, correct ideas, and be the capacity to live in accordance with those things. That's Bechira Chafis. Those are your sodos. And your first obligation is to save yourself. I say save, what do you mean, from what? What's going to happen to me? Save my... Well, I mean, if you're just going to allow nature to take its course, which is the philosophy of contemporary society, do your own thing. That's exactly what it was. Like, you know, the drug culture got started with the full philosophy that man is basically an animal, like any other animal, and that the reason why people are so unhappy and miserable is because they're inhibiting their emotions. And if you just let the emotions go, then man will be okay. So it was some phrase that light up something, you know, like basically that's where drugs came into the picture. Because since they, for some reason, I don't know, what do you need drugs for? Why don't you just live your philosophy? Obviously they had a problem implementing the philosophy. So drugs kind of helped them get loose, loosen them up. But the answer is it's totally false. Because a man cannot be happy just by following his emotions. He's just not constructed for that kind of... An animal can. That's why, by the creation of the animals, I mean, it's well, actually, the animals are created the same day as man. One second. This is beautiful. It works out in Bereshis, interestingly enough, the animals, the mammals, the land, not the same mammals, but the land animals, you know, the wild animals, domesticated animals, are created on which day? Good enough. Both the animals and Adam were created on the same day. It would seem to be two separate creations, right? That's a question that always comes up every year. I'm not going to give you my explanation at the moment. I'll let you think about it. But if you take a look, there is a division, not by a different day. But it says in Perek Aleph Chaf Hey, it says Ayas Elokim et Chayas Aretz Lamina V'yata Behem Lamina. The wild animals are domesticated to their species. V'yes Kol Remes Adama. Okay, and all of the crawling things, Lemineu, Vayar Elokim Kito. God saw that it was good. Then God goes on, in the same day, let us create man, etc., and then Adam was created. But doesn't say that God saw that it was good. Interesting. But the animal says that God saw that it was good. So the term that it was good is being utilized on the creations of the sixth day, but only by the animals, not by man. Yeah, the animals are good by nature. Good meaning in line with their purpose. No, in line with their purpose. But man's goodness depends upon the exercise of his free will. It's not programmed into his instinct. That's why when a person is born, you can't say anything, whether it's good or whether it's not good. You don't know. Man defines himself. Man defines himself. Even in the case of Esav was not predetermined to be a Russian. That's
not predetermined.
We all have predispositions.
So what?
But that's not. Then Yaakov also had a predisposition, which that could also have led down the wrong path. No, because a person with compassion, a person.
It can be conducive.
The Rambam writes about that in the Shmona Prokham, and that the idea of free will does not. It means that no one is predetermined by nature to be a tzaddik or a rasha, because everything depends upon the use of his will. But there are different types of constitutions. I'll agree with that. The Rambam writes about that, which means to say that for some people, certain things are going to be harder than others. But I believe that each person's got what Rabbi Moskowitz refers to as their pekel. You ever hear him?
No.
Since we're creatures of emotion, and since there's a wide variety of emotions, you see, so there's going to be different dispositions. Alright? Now, some people in some areas, I guess you could use these terms. If you're talking about just in general, roughly doing the good, conquering their emotions, conquering the instincts, you see? So certainly, like we say, that the materialism or the ego is a very, very difficult emotion to conquer. Now, I've met people, I think this is a predominant one, because everybody has ego. If you don't have any ego, you're not going to be much of anything in this world anyway. And you need a powerful ego to achieve anything. But then it becomes an obstacle, because the very ego itself, you see, will come into conflict with objective reality, which is something we all have to bump our heads against. Okay. So, the thing is, though, that, and then a lot of times you're working on your ego, because you reach a certain level of sophistication where you realize that you're suffering in this world a great deal of unnecessary pain and hurt and humiliation and heartache, etc., your friends, this, that, or you're struggling, you realize how much you're doing in life is just purely to get the approval of other people. It certainly dawns on you how you're so totally dependent upon other people's approval and how crushed you are when you don't get it, you know, and you realize that this is a major problem in your life. You'd be so much happier if you didn't have this. You know, you can't help it, but you do have an ego, you are sensitive, and you do care what people, and no matter how many shurim you've heard, that there's no reality to it, who cares what somebody else thinks? You should only be concerned about what you are, and God knows what you are, but that makes sense to you. But the next time out there, and you think that people are laughing at something you said,
you know, not in the way you want them to, so you get hurt. And then you look at other people who are very humble. And just by nature, they just don't have a big ego problem. By nature, and you envy them. See? Now, I would say that there are people, each person, it's hard to go into these things. Some people have very little desire for materialism. They're not interested. They don't really care. They're satisfied to live in very, you know, minuscule life. And other people need beautiful things and all that. And some people have a tremendous tithes for food, or aggressive, or sexual, whatever the case may be. Now, that some people may be fortunate, and their disposition, I would say you do fine. It's hard to say. But I say in certain cases, I think about a person like Einstein, for example. And again, it's all from the outside, because you didn't know the struggle. The Vilna Gaon appeared to be like someone who's by nature, naturally, like just learned 22, you know, like learning, never sleeping, just learning. And it would seem like it's by nature, like he's not even a human being, he's just an angel. His body was basically like an accident. But from what I've heard, he himself used to say that if people understood what the Yetzer Hara he has, they wouldn't believe it.
Really?
So, things to that effect, yeah. I don't know, I mean, again, this is not really that scientific, but that's what I've heard. It wouldn't surprise me. It would not surprise me. Because I'll say, the greater the person, the greater the Yetzer. So a person without a Yetzer can't do anything in this world, can't do great things. Most people have, you know, a person of low level energy, psychic energy. That's why the Rambam said that the time to do tshuva is in youth. That whole concept of tshuva gemurah and tshuva sheni gemurah. I want to take that up. You can know it's not a problem. It means to say that there are different dispositions, and for some people, they have, if you want to talk in general about the physical, they're very powerful instinctual natures. Okay? But that doesn't mean to say that the power of the Ratzon, of the free will that God has implanted, it has the capacity. That's a yesod of Aramuna. That's a yesod of Aramuna. Okay, that a person has the capacity to overcome, to conquer his yetzer. If you deny that, then you're denying Torah. You can't have it both ways. The only thing we see is that for some people, and again, it's very hard because you don't see everything. What you see is that you don't know the soul of another person, the heart of another, no matter how close you are to that person, you don't know their struggle. Nobody knows another person's struggle. That's why each person has a certain amount of sympathy. Well, we don't have true sympathy because you're very sympathetic to your own. A person's always sympathetic. They always have a different way of measuring their own problems. And they seem to think that for another person, what's the big deal? You know, they're much more demanding of other people, even parents with children. And not realizing, what about your own laziness? Well, that's different, you know. You always... your ego, that's the ego, your tendency to protect yourself and to be much more harsh in judging other people. You don't really know. The truth is you don't really know, but the idea that each person has the capacity to conquer the Ata Timsholbo, that was the problem. We see that in the whole story of Cain and Hevel. And you know, Cain was very, very upset when Hevel's carbon was accepted and his was rejected. And God spoke to him, communicated with him. And he told him, he warned him about the force of the inclinations, the emotions that were gathering strength. But he asked Timsholbo that he had the capacity to conquer them. So that's the philosophy of Yadus. Okay, to get back to this point, a person's, in terms of your obligation in life, they are in two areas. Of course, it all goes back to the self. But one is primarily the self. Okay? The primary concern, you basically just with yourself. Now, when I say with yourself, that doesn't mean giving tzedakah for yourself, but I mean to work on yourself. For example, in your early years, you go to your yeshiva, you learn Torah. I mean, you're not going out in the world and helping people, doing things to Klal Yisrael. For a young student who should be in the yeshiva, I made this point many times, gives up his learning because he wants to go out and do things and help Klal Yisrael. Because he's convinced that he knows what he's going to save Klal Yisrael. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense. That's not the proper way to do it. You can't really do anything for Klal Yisrael, for people, to help you. You can't really do much good for people if you yourself don't know what the good is yet.
Right.
So therefore, your first of these years, it doesn't make sense. You got to work on yourself. Now, work on yourself involves two things: obtainment of the proper ideas and Ma'aseh Tov.
In order to do Ma'aseh Tov,
the implementation, like the Rambam says, I'll tell you what the formula of perfection of the self is. What's the formula, and what does the Rambam say? Where would you look? Where would you go to look? We're in Hilchos Teyos. Hilchos Tshuva. Okay? We're in Hilchos Tshuva. In the parak where he speaks about the ultimate reward. Parak Ches, he talks about the ultimate reward of the tzaddik is, the ultimate reward of the tzaddik for keeping the Torah is, HaTova HaTzfuna LaTzadikim, He Chai Ha'ol Mabak. Eternal life. The perfection of the soul, naturally, that soul which has been perfected, which has separated itself from its attachment to the instinctual in this world, it's not a miraculous thing. It automatically, it's designed by nature to be attached to the source of eternal life, which is the Kadosh Baruch Hu, and that soul lives eternally. And the Rambam says that there are different degrees. That's why I spoke to you last week about fulfilling your potential. What potential for what? Well, your full potential as a Talmud Alakim is what you should really be concerned about. Okay, that's the measuring rod. Now, a person can have a share in the world to come. That's the Gemara says, Yesh Kona Olamo B'Sha'achas. A person can acquire his eternity in a Sha'achas. But that's not a good, that's, who, they cry, he cried when he heard that. You see, the idea is that, right, Chet explained, he cried because we'll come in here only, how much can you gain? The person can do tshuva on his deathbed. According to Ram, does tshuva on his deathbed and he has a share in the world to come. Yeah, but it's minimalistic. It's good on the one hand, but on the other hand, he's wasted. Look how much he's wasted. Because the extent to which you partake of Olam Haba, and I can't describe this, but you should know the idea. The extent is not the same. There are quantitative differences. Yeah, different. You can relate to that good in a different way. Now, one who is truly concerned about the ultimate good wants to get the best for himself, because we're all selfish. Oh. Everybody's selfish. No one has to say, I don't want the good. The only reason a person rejects Torah is because he can't see that that's the good. He has a false idea of the good. And no one's going to reject Olam Haba. If he acts in a way which causes him to lose it, it's because he doesn't believe. He doesn't believe that one thing, there is such a thing, or that he can relate to it. You see? Now, Kafig Rov Chachmaso V'Godel Maso. That's the formula that he gives. The extent of his knowledge of his chachma and the greatness of his deeds. Now this is a very, very vital point. I want to take some time now to work on this point. The question to you is, what is the idea of you? Is that just two separate things? And God tallies up the score? You know, how much wisdom you bring with you? And then we look at your deeds, and two columns, you know? Well, no, there's one underlying idea behind it. Tamar said it very nicely. That really the essence is knowledge, but you must understand our view of knowledge. The Yadis' view of knowledge. The importance of knowledge. Now that's totally different than the idea of knowledge in today's world. You see, a person that has a lot of ideas, you know, that knows a lot of the philosophy, knows a lot of philosophy, and you can explain, you can define, and clarify. You see? But then he does not act in accordance with that knowledge, that he's lacking chachma. That means that for him the knowledge is purely an external acquisition. It doesn't permeate the soul. The chacham is the one, all of whose convictions, all of his emotional energy is in line with his chachma. You see? The purpose of chachma is to bring you into a relationship with the Kadosh Baruch Hu. So if it's just outside of the real self, it doesn't penetrate and affect your actions, your whole life, you're not living in accordance with your knowledge, that means that you're a schizophrenic personality. That's not perfected. There's no perfection there. You see? The perfection of knowledge is only insofar as the knowledge is a part of your soul, has become internalized, part of your soul, and it is your prime mover, because that's the, all of your energies, which are related to your conviction about reality, your whole conviction of reality is determined by your knowledge. So therefore your emotions are in line, and you love the good, you see? That's the highest level of perfection, where a person naturally enjoys, he loves doing the good, because he sees clearly how what he's doing is really in his best interest. You see, you never lose that. That's the formula. But I mean to say that that's not the way the world is today. Most people, for many people, by the way, knowledge becomes an obstacle. Knowledge can be a lot of people with knowledge. I mean, they learn, right? What the world calls learned people, and even religious, and even rabbis. The fact that they're so smart and so learned, if they're not perfected. And then the very fact that they're so learned can become a problem, because they develop a certain haughtiness and they can never admit. It's very hard to get these people to ever admit they're wrong. That's a defect. You know, certain people, I don't want to allude or refer to any any people or situations that, you know, in existence. But I'm just saying, as a phenomenon in general, that for certain people who don't love the truth, but they lie, they're using the knowledge gives them a certain sense of power or whatever it is, ego satisfaction. Not that is inherently, you know, that's lowish run and all that, but that itself can be an obstacle, because some people become very haughty, and you see that that's the conflict we mentioned before. Now when there's if the knowledge is for this love of truth, so then when you're mistaken and someone corrects you, you'll be happy, because you've gotten close to the truth. But if the knowledge is for the sake of your ego, and now someone corrects you, you've made a mistake. Oh, so what? This define. You have to define yourself. What is the most important thing to you? Is knowledge a means to your ego? You see, or is it all a means to the love of truth? Now a person can be. Let me make. You know, it's not either or, because we're not pure souls. So most people that are really making progress in learning do have an ego involved. But the ego, if the test would be, which is subordinate to which? In a crucial challenge where your ego is on the line, does your love of truth overcome the personal ego? That's what I would expect of a person. I wouldn't demand that you have, no, that you're purely, pure love is the truth, there's no ego involved. That's a very high level. The Ram talks about that. That's the highest possible level. And he says even very, you know, many, not every Talmud Chacham reaches that level. But I maintain that, okay, so we need a certain amount of lolishmati energy. Yeah, but that should be subordinate. It's okay. It's okay if the energy from the ego motivates you to learn Torah, but that serves as the motivation. When you're involved in learning a Torah, then you put aside the ego, and the love of truth comes first. You're able to overcome your Yetzer. See, that's called Kovashis Yisro. You can conquer Yetzer. But if the exercise itself is purely one of ego, so that you were prepared to distort the facts, as you see people, a lot of times people arguing dishonestly, taking things out of context, just to defend their position, then it's already a questionable thing. Then is this person gaining perfection at all? That's a questionable thing. You see, that's a very important idea. But the concept of perfection in Yahadus is, insofar as the knowledge affects your soul, then it's perfecting your soul. And you're becoming a different person. But knowledge which doesn't affect the soul, because the Rambam says, in other words, it's really the knowledge, but Godel Masav is a modification, a qualification, as to whether that's true knowledge, you see, which has effectuated the entire soul, or whether it's just an external acquisition. You see, we're talking about some people that naturally like to do the good, you see? But there's no such thing as a person that naturally likes to do the good. That's just not, that's false. Well, tell me why. Is it possible to speak? I maintain that you cannot speak of a person who naturally likes to do the good. Okay? True or false? Or, you know, let me hear. Because there's no such thing, it's an impossibility to speak of a person who naturally loves to do the good. There's no such thing. Never has been, never will be. It is because, as Noe points out, it's impossible, because the good can never be identified with any particular emotion. Acting compassionately is not good. You see? Being from is not good. Being religious is not good. Whatever emotion you can identify in the human psyche and tell me that's good, that's a false idea. That's part of the corruption of Jewish philosophy today, which is part of, you know, been affected by Christian thinking. To try and instill certain feelings. If a person feels a certain way, then he's automatically good.
Yeah, but there are emotions
that's
that are
false.
More in line.
That's
with
different.
The
but
idea
that's, that's not what I, that's not a breakdown of what I said. I said a person can naturally. A person can only naturally, you say, like to do certain actions that are in line with his emotion, but those actions aren't necessarily the good.
Right,
so you can't say he likes to do the good. He just likes to satisfy those emotions.
Okay.
For example, a compassionate person may sometimes have to conquer it. That's the test of Avram. Shekavash Rachamav Lasos Ritzolcha. The test of Avram was that he was able to overcome his emotion of compassion. For him, that was the most. Avram represents Chesed, as I said. That was the most powerful emotion that he had, and especially with regard to his own son, given all the circumstances and so on and so forth. So what do we say this in the Tfilos of Rosh Hashanah, I believe, in Muslims. Shekavash Rachamav, he conquered his tenderness, his compassion, Lasos Ritzoncha. That's the only good. The only good is to act in the way prescribed by Kadosh Baruch Hu. That's the good. No one has a natural desire to do that. Because by nature you only have instincts and emotions. That's all you have. Now, sometimes your emotions may be in line. Of course, a person will always you know, make a virtue out of necessity. When a person does something which he's compelled to because of powerful emotions, he's not going to admit that that's why he did it. You see? He'll say, well, because that's why, you know. First, has a tremendous and obsessive need to please people, to get their approval. So that's the kind of person that's in shul, always volunteering and doing, you know. Because he, but then, and then when people will praise them, that's exactly, and they'll, well, why are you doing it? Well, he's not going to say because I have an obsessive compulsive need for approval. Because it's important, I recognize we have to have a shul and it's a community and nobody's going to do it, then what's, you know, it's going to make a whole, like, he's an idealist. Right? Oh, really? Is that really an idealist? I know. So, that even if a person has, certain kinds of emotions which superficially appear to be more in line, as you say, with the Torah's philosophy, or less opposed, you follow? Yeah. But the real perfection of Adam is going to be with a struggle. Gotta be with a struggle. Then, because if the person, just follows the natural inclination, which is not to kill anybody, but that itself is not going to bring about real perfection, because the Rambam said, "Lafi good," not just go to Masa, you see, except with both actions, the Masa without the Chachma.
The two are not mutually exclusive. You see,
I understand. I'm just saying that it's still a big life per se. The perfection per se is still a struggle. You see, the pasuk indicates that Moshe Rabbeinu said, for Moshe Rabbeinu, although you do see, by the way, we always have to kill. Sometimes I just, you know, we have to use our own speculation. If we have a pasuk, we should go by the pasuk. This question is alluded to. Where in the Torah? Where in the Torah? There's a pasuk that talks, I think, alludes to this Tamar. You'll decide whether we're correct or not. Moshe in his Musar to Klal Yisrael, the Ati Yisrael, and now Israel. Mother Shem Lekecha Shol Neimach. What does the Lord your God ask of you? What does God want from you? Kiyem Liyiras Hashem Lekecha, but only to fear the Lord your God. Olechas b'chol derachav, to walk in all of his ways, uliyava also, and to love him. V'la'aretz Hashem lekecha, and to serve the Lord your God. V'chol levavcha, v'chol nafshecha, with all of your heart and all of your soul. Lishmar es mitzvos Hashem, to guard the commandments of God, v'yeschut kosav and his statutes. Asher anochim etzav chayom l'tovlach. Okay? So I've committed you l'tovlach, for your benefit. That's very important. Everything in the Torah is l'tovlach. What am I commanding you? For who? For you, l'tovlach, for your benefit. Now, I read it with a certain nuance, in a certain way, right? Now, is that justified? Was my trup correct? I read it as like, what's the big deal? Right? What is with you people? What does God want from you? Nothing. Small stuff, right? To God all through all of his ways, with all your heart and all. Right? There's a Gemara in the Flaming Gilam Beis and Brachos. So it says like this. Rav Chanina, Hakol Bidei Shemayim. Everything is in the hands of heaven. Chutz Miyur Shemayim. That you're familiar with, except the fear of God. Okay? Shneimar, it says, V'ati Yisrael, quotes this pasuk. Ma Hashem Lekecha Shol Neimach, Ki Im Liyira, except to fear. So it mentions fear, among other things. Okay. Now the Gemara says, "Atu Yerushalayim Milsa Zitrasi." It's just a small thing. In other words, Moshe is saying it's like an no big deal. Like, what is God asking of you? That's the whole way. You have to, you know, there's an intonation over there. Like, what is the problem? Okay, and then he goes on to list many other things besides Yira. So the Gemara is asking that question. How can he talk this way to Klal Yisrael? He's talking about big stuff. This is a small thing. All right. So the Gemara. Then it goes to prove that it's not an easy thing. God does not have in his treasure storage house, so to speak, kivyachol, of course, except the otzar, a storage of Yerushalayim. Shenema Yerus Hashem hi otzaro. Okay, so that would imply that it's not an easy thing. So the Gemara says like this: In legave Moshe mills of the drossi. You're right. For Moshe, it was an easy thing. It was no big deal. But for the rest of us, it's certainly a bit. In other words, Moshe, apparently, I want to maintain that Moshe changed, also, not today, remind me, that Moshe actually changed, has modified his position on this issue, later on in Devar. But apparently Moshe was, was wrong, so to speak, because he was projecting something onto Klal Yisrael. He was from his own experience. See, Moshe was so perfected, he was so in line with reality that he couldn't understand what is the problem. This is the good. L'tavlach. This is to fear God, to walk in all His ways, to do the right thing. What's the problem? What else are you going to do? Be insane, live an insane existence? I mean, what's your problem? So Moshe apparently didn't comprehend that for ordinary mortals it is a big problem. Alright? But that's from Moshe Rabbeinu. In other words, I think then there is some truth, I would say, that if you get from an objective standpoint, there are certain dispositions which are more attuned, so to speak, if you're going to, hard, easy, we're using these terms roughly, to perfection. More in line. But that doesn't mean that they're perfected. They have to exercise their bechira. A person like Einstein, for example, comes to mind. Someone with a great mind that's naturally attracted to chacham. He achieved a certain type of perfection, but he was not perfected in Torah. I'm just using him as a marshal. And someone who doesn't really have powerful, instinctual desires or whatever. When he writes his description of his experience in pondering the chacham of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is like the Rambam's description of he didn't get it from there, but it's akin. That state is a state of Avos Hashem. He really achieved the state of Avos Hashem. By the way, through the Chachma of Hashem in nature. As the Rambam says, that's one of the avenues through which a person can acquire Avos Hashem. Now, a person on that level, and the instinctual, it's everything in this world, he looks about the rest of the world chasing after fantasies and illusion, and he has the greatest experience, he's in a different world, so it is a lot easier, I'd say. Okay? So, it is possible, it is, from a theoretical standpoint, I would say, that, you can speak of a person's disposition, some people, that's mazel, that's the way the world is constructed, and you mentioned other factors. What about the fact, you can't ask if what's bothering you is a certain type of equality here, a certain fairness. I don't think that we can ask that question, because the other fact is, what about a person that was born, his parents were more rational than the other, gave him a better upbringing, got better teachers, and so on and so forth. I mean, that's part of reality, a different issue. That's part of the will of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that the world should exist in that way, and a person shouldn't be envious. A person should be thankful for his chelak, sameach chelko, because that's your reality. You should never be jealous of somebody else, because that's your reality. God designed you, and obviously that's the only reason you have existence. That's the only purpose of your existence. That's the only reason you have existence, and you should be very happy with your own nature, and your only objective should be to secure the perfection of your own nature. That's all. Envy is a complete distortion of reality. So this is part of reality, that there are different, people have different, each person has different qualities. And it's not just that, it's situations. A person can have a greater, you don't know how many people have greater minds, but their parents don't give them the proper education, and so on and so forth. There's just too many factors. So, theoretically speaking, I would agree, but I don't think it makes any practical difference in our lives. Okay, I just wanted to remind me to get back to the two elements of perfection, getting back to the others. I want to tie it back to the others and then move ahead with the Chumash.